Oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court. Be seated, please. Case number 053201, United States of America versus James T. Foster, appellant. Ms. Rowland for the appellant, Mr. Kavanaugh for the appellee.
Good morning. May it please the court, Sandra Rowland for appellant Mr. James Foster. Before the court today is the question whether the harm inflicted by Detective Quigley's surprise other crimes testimony was cured by the jury instruction to disregard it. The district court found that the other crimes testimony signaled the collapse of the defense strategy and was harmful to the defendant's interests, but that the harm was cured by the instruction. Appellant respectfully disagrees. We know that jury instructions to disregard evidence can't always cure the harm, or there would never be mistrials following inadmissible evidence. In the context of this case, no instruction could have cured the prejudice. The mental gymnastics required for jurors to forget or disregard that Quigley accused appellant of being involved in another earlier drug sale is nearly impossible for jurors who are deciding whether they have a doubt about the officer's misidentification in count, or identification in count one, and whether they have a doubt about his constructive possession of the drugs
in
count three.
Where in the transcript is the is this passage?
About the collapse of the defense strategy?
The passage about the prior drug transaction you're referring to.
Excuse me. On November 12th, mm-hmm. in the morning transcript, Detective Quigley first testified on direct examination that the first time she met him was on June 27th, and that is at page 32. During cross-examination at pages, same transcript, at pages 56 and 57, she said, "I knew him from the previous buy, from a previous buy." And then later, "I met Mr. Foster." That's the testimony that we complain of. If appellant had made an earlier sale to Detective Quigley, that would be highly relevant to whether the identification was reliable, and it would be relevant to whether he was merely present on the final date. Without the other crimes evidence, the government did not have a strong case. It was a one-witness, fairly weak identification, and
it was his house. He was married to the woman who physically handed out the drugs. You said that, so it's a case of misidentification, that it was a weak case? It seems overwhelming to me.
The government alleged that it was his house. What the police found in the apartment to connect appellant was his marriage license and one old identification. They found nothing else, no mail, no clothing, nothing that linked him to the apartment. I think, you know, if the police search my house today, they will find many, many, many things linking me to the house, not just one, you know, identification that's a few years old and my marriage license.
He was present at the transactions.
Well,
I mean, the linkage to the apartment doesn't seem to be significant when he's in the apartment.
He was in the apartment on the final date when Deborah Waldrop and he were both arrested. His defense as to count one was that he was misidentified, that he was not present on that date. He was acquitted on count two by the judge, and on another date in which she visited the apartment, he wasn't present. So there was one date in which he was clearly present.
That was the day that the police came in and arrested him, right?
Exactly.
He was clearly present then.
Yes, and his conduct on that day did not obviously or clearly demonstrate that he was involved in the drug sales. Detective Quigley's testimony about what he did other than answer the door was very equivocal. She kept telling the story that Deborah Waldrop handed drugs to the woman who had come in later. Over and over again, she testified that it was Deborah Waldrop. And when she was finally asked the question, she said, you know, who was it who handed the woman the drugs? She said, Deborah Waldrop, I mean Mr. Foster. Her testimony was not very convincing on that point. And there was absolutely nothing to indicate.
There were several other instances, or at least a couple of other instances, in which she had to, she sort of mangled the names because the couple have different names. Isn't that right?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. Well, I think there's at least one, but we'll come back to that. Go ahead.
Now, this is not your misidentification argument you're making now. This is the sufficiency of the evidence argument.
No. I'm arguing about the issue of the surprise other crimes evidence. Appellant had no notice that Detective Quigley would be testifying that there had been a previous date at which he was involved in a drug buy. She had the discovery from the government. Her testimony on a direct examination all indicated that the first time she met him was on June 27th, the first date alleged in the indictment. On cross-examination, she said, oh, no, you know, when challenged about her identification of him, she said, oh, no, I had met him at a previous drug buy.
Here we go, Ms. Ms. Rowland. Page 44 of that same transcript, 11:12 in the AM. Start at line 11, or in the 13. Mr. Foster got up and opened the door. Line 14, told Mr. Foster that she wanted to buy. 15, Ms. Waldrop told me to wait. She dropped her drugs back in the blue pouch. I just held on to my money. Mr. Waldrop went next to Ms. Foster, reversing the names, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Picked up a Ziploc off the table and handed it to the black female. Now, it's pretty clear from the context what she means, and she corrects herself in the other instance.
It's not clear to me whether she's reversed the names or whether she's reversed the Mr. and Ms.
That's the same thing, isn't it?
I'm not sure that it is. In her...
All right, we'll go on with...
In her other narrative testimony about what happened, she testifies that it's Waldrop. And here, although she says Mr. instead of Ms., she says Waldrop went next to Mr. Foster, which makes some sense since Mr. Foster had been the one who answered the door. So he's standing at the door with the black female. Miss Waldrop goes next to him, and she completely takes over the sale. She negotiates the money, she takes the money, and according to Detective Quigley's narrative, she also hands him the rock of crack. It would be contrary to what
we... So he's just the doorman?
Well...
Isn't that enough?
If he's answering the door, no.
He's in there for the whole transaction. He lets the buyer in.
Well, he's present during the transaction, but mm-hmm. that doesn't mean that he's constructively possessing the crack that went to the black female or the 50 grams of crack that was in Boo's pouch that she kept in the back room and had to go retrieve.
We've held the opposite in a case in 1991, which nobody cites. It's called United States versus Jenkins. Very similar to this. It was an individual's home. The evidence viewed most favorably to the government here shows that. And there was no direct evidence. In fact, in that case, it was somewhat weaker, but there was no direct evidence of any handling of the drugs, whereas there is here, at least on the June 27th. And we said that the most important thing was the most important piece of evidence was the fact that the individual lived there. So
I'm sorry that I'm not aware of that case. I don't know whether there was a co-defendant who was actively involved in the sale in that case, or whether it was simply, you know, a person at home. This is not clearly his home. There is another person who's actively involved. The entire investigation was about Boo, Ms. Waldrop. It was not about Mr. Foster. And the real question here, other than, you know, setting aside the sufficiency of the evidence, is whether the harm of her testifying that there had been a previous buy without any notice to the defendant was cured by the instruction. The defendant had no way to challenge the evidence.
Don't we have some really strong evidence of that in the fact that the jury is told you cannot consider anything before June 27th? They go back and deliberate, and they, I think, two or three times tell the court, we can't reach a conclusion with respect to count one. Now, if they were really considering the fact that she'd testified there had been a prior buy, I don't think, you know, they would have had a problem. I think that's strong evidence that they were disregarding that, and they were trying to decide whether there was enough evidence that identified him on June 27th without regard to anything else Quigley said about how she knew him before.
I agree with the court that the jury was struggling with count one, and that they had to be struggling with the identification. That was the only issue before them. I think that the three deadlock instructions indicate that at least one juror was perhaps not considering the other crimes evidence. But it doesn't tell us what the other 1 to 11 jurors were considering.
The buy report.
Yes, and the buy report was relevant only because it demonstrated that her identification or her description of him on that day was very weak. The government did not have a strong case on count one. This evidence that he could not counter in any way, he couldn't cross-examine it, he couldn't subpoena the confidential informant. He couldn't do anything with it except let it lie and ask the jury to disregard it. That evidence is just the sort of thing that can tip the balance toward conviction.
Well, the fact that the judge immediately gave the curative instruction, in other words, what you're arguing for is almost an automatic mistrial. Anytime unfairly prejudicial evidence comes in.
No.
We can't do that.
No. I'm arguing that in the context of this case, where his only only defense on count one was his misidentification bolstered by his alibi witnesses, and his defense on count three was that he was merely present, this testimony, as the district court said, cut the legs off of the defense. There was no more, there was no more defense after she said that. And yes, she was instructed, the jury was instructed, but our argument is, in this context, with this defense, having other crimes evidence, which we know is devastating, it's the nail in the coffin in any case in which it's presented, other crimes evidence about which you've had no notice, you can't investigate it, you can't cross-examine it, you can't call your own witnesses. In that circumstance, where 404B, the notice requirement of 404B is violated, a mistrial should result, and a reversal should result here. I think that that's a very narrow circumstance, and is not the case that whenever inadmissible evidence comes in, a reversal or a mistrial is required. As to the strength of the government's case, I think the court is right that the jury was struggling on count one, where really the only question was whether he was present on that day or whether it was someone else. it was a one witness case. Her description of him, or description of the person in the buy reports, was very scant. Black male, 6'3 to 6'5. The second time.
How tall is the defendant?
6'1.
She was never asked if the person you saw in August was the person you saw in June.
Not that I recall. No. But no. I mean, her testimony just, you know, she said Mr. Foster sitting there is the person who was there in June, and Mr. Foster sitting there is the person in August, but she was never asked more directly. Right. Right. And she identified him in the courtroom.
Ms. Rowland, we're well over time here. Was there something brief on another point?
Unless the court has questions, we'll rest on our briefs as to the sufficiency of the evidence.
I'll give you a minute for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Chris Kavanaugh on behalf of the United States. The district court did not abuse its discretion in denying appellant's request for a mistrial, a severe remedy which this court has characterized as a step to be avoided whenever possible. Detective Quigley's testimony about having met appellant during a previous drug transaction was isolated, brief, and extremely confusing. Even the trial judge, as the unbiased observer in the courtroom, once the parties approached the bench, thought that Detective Quigley was confused about a question of dates, actually. And it wasn't even until the parties heard the testimony again, as read back by the court reporter, that appellant then moved for a mistrial. This was the only time that this previous drug transaction was ever mentioned. It was not mentioned again on cross-examination, in redirect examination, any rebuttal evidence, or closing argument by the prosecutor, as the prosecutor represented and assured the trial court. Additionally, it's not only prejudice that this court should look at, but it's unfair prejudice. And it's important to note that the defense counsel in this case elicited this testimony on cross-examination. This was not affirmatively introduced by the government. And the defense counsel in this case asked a question to which he did not know the answer. He received an answer which he did not like. Now, that answer was confusing, but nevertheless, he already had the record upon which he can make the argument of misidentification. As the prosecutor had not elicited any testimony of any events prior to June 27th in Detective Quigley's direct testimony. Nevertheless, the defense counsel in this case asked the one question too many, and he received an answer which he did not like. Now, appellant argues on page 22 of their brief that this sounded the death knell for their misidentification defense and painted Mr. Foster as a liar. That is quite an exaggeration, specifically because the defense counsel even reserved their opening statement in this case. They had yet to broadcast that they were proceeding on a misidentification defense to the jury. So it's important to note that not only is there prejudice that they're looking at, but also whether or not there is any unfair prejudice. Additionally, Your Honors, there was a curative instruction in this case, which appellant had his hand in crafting. As the trial court made the suggestion of the curative instruction after the mistrial was denied, an appellant had his hand in crafting exactly what he wanted, and he received that exact same curative instruction. And the evidence establishing appellant's identity on June 27th of 2002 was compelling indeed, as Detective Quigley stated that she was in this apartment for 5 minutes, that she focuses on people's faces from whom she is making a purchase of narcotics transactions. It was well lit inside the apartment. She was 2 to 3 feet away.
But I thought her only identification was a black male between 6'3 and 6'5.
That is all she included in her undercover buy report. And she was cross-examined on that exact same issue.
What else did she say in her court testimony?
In her court testimony,
any more detail?
She didn't provide any more detail, but nevertheless, the prosecutor did lay the proper foundation in order to establish the in-court identification, and even the parties approached to make sure that before the in-court identification was made that there was proper foundation, and provided defense counsel with the opportunity to object. Additionally, Your Honors,
no objection was made.
Not at that time, Your Honor. It was the defense counsel stated that he appreciated that there was going to be an in-court identification of the defendant. And appellant cannot point to any reason that this court should not rely on the presumption that jurors will follow the curative instruction of the trial court, especially when appellant had the affirmative hand in crafting that instruction.
deadlock on count one?
Your Honor, my read on the deadlock is, specifically I point to the case of United States versus John Williams, I believe a decision which you wrote, which in footnote 10, this court noted that we should hesitate to assign any significance with respect to the government's case, based upon the length of deliberations. And the government submits the same thing should be applied for the deadlock note, as the length of a deliberation very well that could represent a deadlock jury, whether or not they're communicating notes may or may not be.
Disregarding the 404B?
Well, Your Honor, I would be ignoring your advice not to assign any hesitance to that, but of course, yes, that's the government's position, that they were ignoring any evidence of prior testimony. But more importantly, Your Honor, it's not that they were ignoring it, but the testimony was just that confusing. As, again, it was even the trial judge didn't understand what happened. It's that she said that Detective Quigley's testimony was a confusion of dates, actually.
Are you conceding that this was, in fact, evidence within the meaning of 404B?
No, we're not conceding that, Your Honor. In fact, we took no position on that in our brief because there's an inadequate record from which the government could take a position.
Was the jury instructed that mere presence at the scene of a drug transaction is not evidence of guilt?
In the curative instruction, it was not, Your Honor, and I don't believe that instruction was made in the...
What is the law if the government is not going to introduce evidence that comes within the meaning of 404B, and the defense then elicits it in cross-examination as here, how is it that the government is to anticipate that happening and give notice? Does the government have to give notice of 404B evidence that might spill out in a cross-examination?
Your Honor, obviously that was not briefed before the court, but nevertheless, research was conducted as far as this jurisdiction's law on whether or not notice must be given for anticipatory defense cross-examination. And in this jurisdiction, the government was not able to find anything on that precise issue.
We don't have any cases on that, right?
No, sir. However, the Eighth Circuit does.
What do other circuits?
In the case of United States versus Andrew Jones, the Eighth Circuit rather summarily stated that other crimes evidence elicited by defense counsel on cross-examination of the government's case agent, just as we have in this case here, was not 404B evidence, Your Honor. And that was the case of United States versus Andrew Jones, I believe from 1998 in the Eighth Circuit.
And here, I take it your argument is that the government could not have anticipated this, even though the prosecutor only found out the morning of trial. Is that right?
Your Honor, the prosecutor found out the morning of trial that there was a prior relationship, with appellant.
But the government wouldn't anticipate that coming across because when the trial started, there was no opening statement indicating that the defense was going to put on a misidentification defense.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. And the prosecutor specifically narrowed their direct testimony to not introduce any evidence for prior to June 27, 2002. Now, there's one important thing with respect to the first issue before the court that I want to correct for the record. And on direct testimony, I believe appellant stated that Detective Quigley stated that the first time she met appellant was on June 27th of 2002. That's incorrect. The testimony, I believe on page 32, is that this was the first buy in this investigation happened on June 27th of 2002. Detective Quigley did not state that was the first date upon which she met appellant. Your Honor, moving to the second...
Well, on the cross-examination, actually, she was asked, now this blackmail was somebody you didn't know from the past, or well, let me just say this blackmail was somebody that you didn't know.
That's exactly right.
And she then answers, I knew him from a previous buy.
From a previous buy, that's correct. And unfortunately, there was no evidence upon which that would provide more about that previous buy. And the only thing in the record to provide any context to this court is in the government's, in a prosecutorial proffer by the government in its motion, in its opposition to defendant's motion for a new trial, in which the prosecutor proffered inside the motion that essentially Detective Quigley was present with a special employee, and it was the special employee that made the purchase. But unfortunately, there is no evidence or testimony that's been entered in on the record on that.
Any further questions?
I do have one question on the other count. When they asked for, when they said they were deadlocked on the first count, did they say anything about the second count?
No, they specifically mentioned that they were only deadlocked with respect to the first count.
Okay.
And may I make one last quick point, is that appellant specifically stated that there was nothing linking appellant to the apartment, and that is simply inaccurate, as not only was his marriage license there, he had a photo ID there, he was there on three separate occasions, and again, this was on page 107 of the afternoon transcript of November 12th of 2003, Detective Dessen actually stated that there was a normal amount of male clothing inside the bedroom of the apartment. And that was actually not included inside the government's brief, Your Honor. And for that, I apologize.
Thank you, Mr. Kavanaugh.
Thank you.
Mr. Rowland, do you have any rebuttal to what we just heard, particularly with regard to the clothing?
Yes, I object to the characterization that defense counsel asked a question to which he did not know the answer. He had every reason to believe that he did know the answer. Detective Quigley's testimony on...
we're not faulting defense counsel here. Defense counsel, in fact, I think quite correctly said after the bench conference, well, I can get out of where I am, but I don't appreciate being put in the place where I am. And he then proceeded to do just that.
There was nothing he could do to get out of where he was.
But what is, except by, let's not repeat. What about rebuttal? Do you have anything on the male clothing in the closet? Or?
I'm not aware of that testimony. I know that there was no photographs taken and there was no clothing seized. I can't just argue that there wasn't testimony. I'm not sure about that.
Excuse me one second. Mr. Kavanaugh, was that testimony?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you. We'll find it.
There was no basis for defense counsel to object to the identification of appellant by Detective Quigley earlier. So, you know, it's up to him to challenge that on cross-examination, not object to it happening. And the government did not argue in its brief that this was not 404B evidence, thereby, in our view, conceding the issue. The district court, in the motion for a new trial, found that it was 404B evidence and that it did harm appellant, and it did sound the death knell for the defense, but that the instruction cured the problem.
That the way that this case is being presented to us, there's a confusion between, was this 404B evidence on the one hand, in which case the government had to give pretrial notice that it was going to use that evidence or introduce it, right? But that's not what happened here. The government didn't introduce. And the confusion is between 404B evidence on the one hand and the usual discovery, a Jenks Act type discovery that occurs prior to trial. And it's certainly not Brady material because it's incriminating against the defendant. And I'm not even sure it's Jenks material because it was not and certainly the government, there's no bad faith on the part of the prosecutor. Nobody disputes that the prosecutor didn't find out until the morning of trial.
Yes.
And had no idea, could not have had any idea that misidentification was going to be a defense.
Oh. There was no other defense. Of course it was misidentification. And we do not lay blame for this at the feet of the prosecutor. We lay blame for this at very experienced Detective Quigley, who has been involved in many, many federal court cases, and who apparently withheld that information from the prosecutor. This case started with a confidential informant. The case was indicted so that it did not include the confidential informant. And apparently she never told the prosecutor. Now, when the prosecutor learned on the morning of trial that she had previously met Quigley had previously met Miss Waldrip, but didn't believe that Mr. Foster was involved, that, in fact, was Brady evidence. The fact that there were drug sales in which he was not present was Brady evidence and should have been disclosed then. Again, you know, we think that Detective Quigley failed the prosecution, the defense, and the court. And, you know, it was not the prosecutor's fault what happened. But when...
I want to get back to this question again. I'm looking at Rule 404B, and it talks about the evidence of other crimes, wrongs or acts, not admitting, you know, all the rest of that. And then it says the prosecution in a criminal case shall provide reasonable notice in advance of trial of the general nature of any such evidence it intends to introduce at trial. So how can this be? That's 404B. This was not evidence that the government intended to introduce at trial. So how can it possibly be 404B evidence?
In that case, what the government did introduce was perjury, unknowingly. The prosecutor didn't know, but Detective Quigley said, she was asked, how did you first come to that location? I received information from a special employee that drugs were being sold out of that apartment. What did you do after you got that information? I went to the area of the location and went to the apartment to purchase narcotics. Was that first on June 27th? Yes. After that testimony, her testimony was the first time was June 27th.
First time what?
The first time that she went to the location.
To purchase drugs?
And the first time, well, after that information, I went to the location, and I went to purchase narcotics. Was that first on June 27th?
Where was the previous buy?
We don't know.
We don't know. So how can that possibly be perjury? If the first time she goes to the apartment is June 27th, and that's what she says, you know, she may have met Mr. Foster out on the street 2 miles away in a previous buy.
Okay. I don't think that that's what came out later from the prosecutor. The first time was at the apartment. And that is splitting hairs.
How can this possibly be 404B evidence if the government doesn't intend to introduce it at trial?
Because the government can't offer unwittingly perjured testimony.
That's a different argument. That's a different
argument. And then when the defense counsel asks the same question and gets a different answer, say, well, we didn't elicit it. You did. His question was not different than the prosecutor's question.
Thank you, Ms. Rowland. Case is submitted.